Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, February 26th. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the show, we welcome Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region to discuss Black history. The couple is restoring the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Albany, which was a key location for the Underground Railroad and abolitionist efforts in New York. Mary Liz and Paul join us today to talk about their efforts and to answer your questions about African American history. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mary Liz and Paul Stewart, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the show, we welcome Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region to discuss Black history. The couple is restoring the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Albany, which was a key location for the Underground Railroad and abolitionist efforts. Mary Liz and Paul join us today to talk about their efforts and to answer your questions about African-American history, particularly in the Northeast, but anywhere, really. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mary Liz and Paul Stewart, welcome back to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ray.
Now, I say welcome back, and it, really, you were on the round. We had a nice chat on the round table sometime in the fall. Mm-hmm. I was guest hosting, and it was such a great conversation that I said we needed more time.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you're here for a full hour today.
That's great, and we're glad to be here, too. I think it's a lot of fun. Vox Pop is a program that I actually tend to catch when I'm in the car in the afternoon.
Oh, and so, I better up my game.
Yeah.
I know that. You know, for those who don't know what it is, tell us about the Underground Railroad History Project and how it began and what the mission is.
Well, I'll start with the mission. Underground Railroad History Project is a results-driven education and preservation organization dedicated to researching and preserving local Underground Railroad history in its national and international context, connecting it with later struggles, and empowering people of all ages to become agents of change to work for an equitable and just society.
Yeah, we really had to work on that. Struggled through, you know.
Is it tough to? I mean, it must take some elbow grease to find the documentation and just get that history.
Yes and no. You know, one of the things that has surprised us. Well, I mean, on the one hand, we find the documentation in surprising places. And, you know, one of the things that I mentioned, that we mention in our talks all the time, is that, for instance, early on when we were asking questions, you know, what's the story locally, you know, we would find things like in the middle of a book called Fugitive Slave Law Days in Boston, 4 pages about Albany. Or we would find a book like Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and halfway through the book, you know, this is about a woman who's enslaved in North Carolina and making her way to freedom in the North, and partway through the book, she's getting on a boat to come to Albany. So these stories and many others certainly are there. And then the way we tell the story, too, it's not narrowly about people's escape. They have other they have lives beyond that. And those lives beyond that is as an important part of the story as that narrative about directly about the escape.
And, you know, maybe because of what it's called, the Underground Railroad, or maybe for other reasons, you automatically get the image of, okay, well, this was a route.
Sure.
But it was more of a movement.
Sure.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things, the way the story has been told in the past, that sort of clouds the way we think about it. You know, everybody's used to seeing these maps with arrows on it. And maps with arrows are good in the sense that they give you an idea of what happened generally, but the specifics aren't there. And, you know, so when you see a map stretching across, a map with an arrow on it, stretching from Maryland through Pennsylvania into New York, that tells you that people went there, but it doesn't really tell you whether they went to Allentown or, you know, Poughkeepsie or what, you know?
Yeah.
And so that more refined story, I think, is what people are much more attracted to, much more interested in. They want to know, were there folks involved in my community, you know, which is a sort of a different, you know, you need a different sort of visual representation of that.
I'd also say that the way that so many of us have learned about the Underground Railroad, about Underground Railroad history, does lead us to believe that it's a small snapshot in time, that it really is about yesterday with no real relevance for today, that if you know about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, you're good. You got it. And, you know, we can move on. And yet, when digging deeply into period documents, voices of people who were engaged in this movement really do have a different accounting than what has historically and contemporarily, too, continues to be marshaled out to us as the story.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's important to put right out up front, and that is that the Underground Railroad does not have to do with anything underground.
Right.
the term came, there are different stories that have been related in terms of where the term came from. But one of the stories is that a man named Tice Davids, who was escaping from enslavement, made his way across the Ohio River. He was being pursued by an enslaver. And when the enslaver got to the other side of the river, it appeared that Tice Davids had disappeared. And he remarked, he must have disappeared on an underground road. This was picked up. And as railroads came into prominence in the 1830s, 40s, et cetera, in terms of their development, people quickly associated that with Underground Railroad because people would seem to disappear somewhere along the Ohio River or along the Maryland border and appear in Canada 2 or 3 days later. How did they get there so fast?
Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project join us today. It's clear, and from our first conversation on the roundtable and today, just how much passion and vigor you have for the chase. Now, you give presentations. I know you did one in Troy not too long, a couple days ago.
Right.
Do you learn new things all the time?
Yes.
Do you pick up little tidbits at some of these that you can follow up on?
We do. I mean, both for sometimes it's returning to documents we've already engaged with, and there's a new insight that emerges. Other times, people from around the state or the country will share new information, and that then informs what we're thinking about and what we're being able to share publicly. So the story continues to grow.
Yeah, like there's a letter that we've had some years ago. We were directed to Katona, New York, where the Jay family homestead was, to look for some documents that had to do with Stephen and Harriet Myers here in Albany. One of them was a letter from Harriet Myers. And so we've had that, you know, kind of in our hopper for a while in terms of, you know, a copy of it that we were able to talk about and that sort of thing. But in recent months, it's really hit home with us in terms of, you know, a window into the story about the Underground Railroad here in Albany and this woman's life, an African-American woman, you know, and she's at home and her husband, Stephen, is away at Lake George working as a butler. And so she's welcoming these freedom seekers into her home and she's going out and raising money. So there are a lot of things about this letter that really have just fascinated us more so in recent months. And that's a good example of something that, you know, we've kind of worked with, but we look at it and all of a sudden it strikes us.
It's
wow,
more than a snapshot.
More stuff in there.
It is, yes. And something else, too, that has been very significant for the research we've done, and that is that our focus has been on African-American abolitionists, and it casts investigating the records left behind by people of color in this story cast a different perspective, a different retelling of this history.
Yeah, there's a lot of documents from blacks who are both as freedom seekers and also as abolitionists that we can return to and explore the story, and it sort of comes out different than the traditional story of, say, maybe the Quaker or the the white farmer in the middle of nowhere, you know, greeting people at his door, that sort of thing. There's a different set of connections that are often made, different linkages, and it's related to other events that are happening around these things as
so
well.
So context is really a big part of what you need to fill in and what you do.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
We're joined today by Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region. Let's grab one call before our break, and then I want to get an update on the restoration of the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Jason in Otisville, New York. Jason, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I live in a house that's well over 100 years old in Otisville. When we purchased the house, there was a manual printing. There still is, actually, because we can't get it out. There's a manual printing press in the basement. And with nothing more than that fact and the fact that African Americans own that house, like at least two generations that I know of, two families, you know, back to back. And just the feeling. I don't know how I find out. I just always had a feeling that that was part of something. In the village that we live in, right outside of the village, there was a resort, an African American resort. So I don't know. It just seems like something. Okay. I don't know.
So could you kind of recap that a little bit? So there's a printing press in the basement. The home was owned by several generations of African Americans, and
right. And just a feeling that I get that it was possibly part of the Underground Railroad, but I have no way of knowing how to check that out, how to research that.
Well, there's two things. One is that there were an awful lot of things going on in that pre-Civil War 19th century period than what we generally pick up in the history books. You know, I'm talking about, you know, business things that were going on, land deals, newspapers being published. I mean, all sorts of things. And it may very well simply be that that's what that's connected with, you know, that there was a newspaper or some kind of publication that was working out of that space. In terms of the Underground Railroad, you know, obviously, I mean, I sort of like have a rank ordering, and I wish I could. There's a thing called the Wellman scale, which is popularly used among Underground Railroad research circles for analyzing, you know, is a space connected to the Underground Railroad story? You know, is there some documentation? Are there other things that could be clearly lead you to that? One of the things that I like to do is I like to first ask, you know, is the building old enough to have been involved in the Underground Railroad? So if it's a building that's younger than 1862, it's probably not a candidate. Mm. If it's a you know, are there do you know who owned the building, and do those people have a history of being involved in the Underground Railroad? In that sense, I mean, I'm thinking.
I only know the last occupants, and their last name was Jeffries, and I don't know how to get in touch. We got the house as a foreclosure, so there was no one living in it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oftentimes it's helpful to kind of do some surveying of newspapers from the period at that time. Because one of the things that does happen a lot of times is that over the years, you know, if there's a historically felt to be a connection with the Underground Railroad, it'll get reported in the newspapers somewhere. And that can often be a clue. We tend to prefer to have, you know, a lot of times people will say, well, here's a building, it's got an odd room.
Yeah.
Was it in the Underground Railroad? And that's certainly a hard way to go about sorting it out. The better way to do it is to find a publication like Frederick Douglass's newspaper, the North Star, or Frederick Douglass's paper, or the Liberator, or one of the other abolition newspapers. Find people in there and then ask, where did they live? Where did they do their work? Where did they conduct their activities?
I'd also like to suggest, Jason, considering accessing the services of both your local librarians and local historic record offices here in Albany. Albany County has a historic record department or agency that has been very helpful for providing the documents from previous period.
County Hall of Records, yeah.
All right, we have to take a quick break here. Paul Stewart, Mary Liz Stewart joining us today from the Underground Railroad History Project. It's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. Paul and Mary Liz Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region join us today. And once again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mary Liz, you just wanted to follow up on our last caller's point just for a moment.
The one thing I also wanted to offer to the question posed by Jason was, in addition to accessing the services of a local historic organizations or municipal agencies that could be available in his region and connecting with local public librarians, I would also like to make the general offer to anyone listening that they're welcome to contact us through the Underground Railroad History Project website to either continue the conversation or, you know, have questions answered we might not be able to address today.
I know we have a link on our Vox Pop page, but what is that URL?
It's undergroundrailroadhistory.org.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Undergroundhistory.org.
Underground Railroad History.org.
Yeah. Underground Railroad History. Right. And then there is a link for email?
Yes. If people just look at the menu on the landing page, there is a contact us option. So it's very easy to access.
Speaking of email, we have one here from Karen in Holland Patton, New York. I'd like to know what your guest thought of the recent movie Harriet about Harriet Tubman, founder of the Underground Railroad.
Well, let's see. Who goes first on this one? Yeah.
Do we have enough time?
We argue about this, I think, a little bit. You know, I liked the movie. I thought it was a good general introduction to the story of, Harriet Tubman. One of the things I didn't like about the movie was that if you were familiar with her story, the movie made a lot of sense. If you're not familiar with her story, you probably could get, you know, a good introduction, but you miss a lot. Mm-hmm. Because there were various people that crept into the movie that they sort of didn't really tell you who they were, you know, like Thomas Garrett, and there was a whole thing with shoes in there, he sort of came in and went out, and I'm not sure they actually said he was Thomas Garrett.
Ah.
I'm going to say that for me, one of the top difficulties I had with the movie Harriet was that it narrowed the understanding of her work for civil rights, for her work that was far more extensive than just her Underground Railroad activism. There also was so much fiction built in. And I know this wasn't a documentary. I get that. But yet, if we think about 12 Years a Slave, the Solomon Northup story, when it was taken from the pages of his narrative and put on the screen, that was an incredibly remarkable and respectful presentation of his real story. So I know it can be done, I just didn't see it being done with Harriet. So I would... My idea is to encourage people to tread carefully and not use Harriet as the end product, but as a stepping stone into the larger story.
Yeah, and I think there were also places where the way it was represented, like for instance, the Battle of the Combahee River, I'm not even sure how to put it into words, but I mean, they brought you to the battle, they sort of like represented it pictorially. But you sort of really didn't get a sense of what happened, you know, in terms of the troops coming up the river in the gunboats and avoiding the what they called torpedoes. We call them mines. The troops disembarking and freeing a large number of people and all that. You know, that really wasn't quite delivered in there, I think.
Well, with all due respect, you two are experts. And so it's very easy for you. You know all of the references and you know, well, this is fictionalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for the general person who really doesn't know all that much, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I would say thumbs down.
I
qualified.
My thumb is in between.
Kind of in the middle. All right. Before we get to the calls, once again, at 800-348-2551, when we were on the roundtable having a chat, we were talking a little bit about the restoration of the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Albany. It is a work very much in progress. How's the progress?
It's coming.
Yeah?
It's exciting. Yes. Just to bring folks up to speed who might not be familiar with this Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, it is a documented Underground Railroad site. It has been accepted as of 2004 on the National
National Register
of Historic Places. It is has been accepted on the National Park Service Network to Freedom. It's also been an invited member of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. So, and it's also a participant, or has been accepted onto the New York State Underground Railroad Freedom Trail, I think is the name, which really doesn't exist right now. But nonetheless, there was a period in time when there was some effort to vet sites in New York State that had clear and obvious evidence, mm-hmm. To be part of the Underground Railroad movement. And so the building itself was purchased by Underground Railroad History Project in 2004. And since that time, we have been in the process of restoring this 10-room Greek Revival architectural building. It was built in 1847 in the city of Albany by a black boat captain by the name of John Johnson. And so the goal of the restoration has been to turn this incredibly historic building with a very rich story back to its elegant state that it was in when Stephen and Harriet Myers lived there in the 1850s, and John Johnson was owning the home at that time.
Yeah, and when we first came on the building, I think our own ignorance of construction and things like that actually worked in our favor, because many people said, "Oh, this is
too daunting."
This is too daunting. Yeah. You're throwing money down a hole, whatever. But then after we got past 2014 and the big push for the exterior restoration, now people are saying, "Oh, you did a nice job on that."
Yeah.
Just to run through, it had there was a wall in the basement that was in the process of collapsing. It was a support wall. There was cement asbestos tile in the back of the building. There were places where the mortar had been washed out from the failure of the gutters and downspouts. All the windows in the back of the building were broken. Almost all the windows on the second floor in front were broken, were non-existent.
Chimneys were gone.
The chimneys were gone.
The
there was a bulge
gone.
In the brick on the east side. There was a hole in the wall. But
it had a great story.
It had a great story. This is a treasure.
And I think just our listeners might get a chuckle out of this, because the organization was able to buy the building. It had gone into foreclosure. Luckily for us, we had no bank account, but we were able to buy the building for a whopping $1,500. Mm. Since that time, we have raised and invested in the exterior restoration of the building nearly $1 million.
Wow.
So it's been incredible.
Yeah.
It's an incredible artifact. It's a touchable place where this new interpretation of this old story, as we often call it, can be experienced. So when you come into the Myers residence, we don't treat this like a standard place. And I'm going to say, I don't want to ruffle the feathers of diehard preservationists, but we invite people to sit on the historic furniture.
Ooh.
We have artifacts that have been dug up in, that are related to this period in this house. We let people handle them, so we talk about them. And if you want to come and try on, so we do have costumes, period-appropriate costumes. We invite people to try them on while we're there. So we try
that
to make it.
That all sounds very fraught with danger to me. I got to be honest with you.
Yeah. And I just want to throw in a note about, as far as the restoration and the preservation work is concerned, for instance, in the basement where the wall was collapsing, what actually happened was that they wanted to replace that wall, and it was a support wall in the basement. So they propped the building up on wooden timbers, and took down the wall, and then took out the main support beam from across the bottom of the building, replaced it with a steel I-beam, and then rebuilt the wall around some steel posts.
Mm.
So
structurally sound.
Yeah. So these are the things that help contribute toward it costing $1 million.
Now the number here on this program, and I promise we'll get to the phones in a minute, but I always have so much fun talking to Mary Liz and Paul that I sometimes get carried away. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll get right to the calls in a moment. Now that it is on the National Register of Historic Sites, there are rules, right? You have to follow strict rules, and you have to do a lot of research to make sure that this is period appropriate.
Which is one of the reasons the cost is as large as it is. And 1847 bricks that fell out, well, we had to replace them with 1847 bricks in the mortar that held those bricks together. We had to have that tested, and then the mortar recreated. It's
worth it, though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it really is.
Absolutely.
And I have to say that it's all, for us, it's worth it because if you think about it, even in the city of Albany, and this is not to be disrespectful to other historic sites, but we have three in the city of Albany, the size that it is. We have three historic sites that have been preserved that pay tribute to wealthy white families that lived in the city of Albany. This is the only building in Albany, in the Capital Region, and in essentially all of New York State that is pays tribute to the contributions of African Americans and reflects the perspective of African Americans from the experience of a man who was enslaved in New York State.
Yeah, who grew up in this quote unquote New Amsterdam sort of area, and was originally his story is that he was born around 1800 at Hoosick Four Corners, which is in Rensselaer County now, mm-hmm. and I think they probably thought it was Albany then or Saratoga or whatever, but he grew up in the city of Albany, got his freedom around the age of 18, worked a variety of different kinds of work, but was very interested in the role that newspapers could play in terms of uplifting the community and providing education. And so he was involved with a whole string of publications, the most well-known of which is the Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate, which came out in the early 1840s. He was involved with the black conventions, the colored men's conventions, as they were called at the time. He was involved with voting rights campaigns with the New York State Suffrage Association. He was involved with economic development projects with the Florence Farming and Lumber Association, even with some job training and readiness project that was kind of the American Council of Colored Laborers. So He was into a lot of things, and of course, how he made his living was working in the food service industry, basically working as a steward on steamboats and as a butler and as a waiter.
And I was going to say in prominent. He worked in prominent hotels.
Prominent
as well,
hotels, so, yeah. Yes, and restaurants here in the city. So, a guy who didn't. Wasn't afraid of using his free time for constructive purposes.
Mm. Yeah. When you were, aside from the spiritual discovery, the first time you walked in this place, that must have been quite an amazing feeling. When you were rehabbing the place, did you ever find anything? Did you discover any secrets that you said, wow?
No.
Yes.
Let's go with the yes first.
No, and I said, yeah. I was thinking of the five... shoes that were found in the attic of the building.
That's right. And that little piece of a corset.
Something?
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And then
metal strips in it. Oh, my God.
Quite interestingly, when we had a group from the State University that were doing some archaeology in the backyard, they found another shoe. So now we have six shoes. Yeah. We had the five shoes evaluated by a conservator, and she dated them from the 1860s to the 1920s.
Mm.
So they weren't Stephen and Harriet shoes necessarily, but they were shoes from somebody who lived in the building.
Right. And they were period appropriate too, which is part of what we try to do is to contribute. So when we talk about Stephen and Harriet Myers and their colleagues, when folks come to the Myers residence, for instance, we try to place our abolitionists in a larger context. You know, they didn't sit around twiddling their thumbs waiting for freedom seekers to come to the door. And
right.
so we try through artifacts, through documents, through, you know, other strategies to create, to contribute to an understanding that these were people who led very busy lives just like we do today. Mm-hmm. And yet they made this commitment to continue to work for justice throughout their
yeah.
lives.
Well, let's grab a call here before our next break. And again, I am so sorry. James in Hudson's been waiting a while. 800-348-2551. James, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to clarify the use of the word underground because it's from the Latin sub rosa, and most educated people would have known at least a little bit of Latin because I don't know much. But it just means goes without notice. So, like when we talk about the Velvet Underground, we're not talking about a subway. It means that they were able to pass through things without anyone any legal challenge.
Yeah, that's
so it's pretty good. And also, I want to thank the guests because I think you're doing wonderful work. I think it's a great thing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you for that comment. I mean, I think that a lot of times. I think what happens is that people, there are two things that happen for people when they hear the word Underground Railroad. One is they think about the underground during the Second World War, I think.
Yeah.
And sometimes they think about some of the other little bits and pieces that are parts of stories that come from the Underground Railroad period. I mean, even when the stories of Harriet Tubman. There are mention, say, for instance, in Sarah Bradford's book, Harriet Tubman, The Moses of Her People, there's mention of Harriet Tubman using potato holes as something, you know, whether just storing food in them or whatever. But the fact that they're there kind of gives that underground thing
yeah.
a little impetus. And I think a lot of times people in 19th century buildings and 19th century construction, they loved tunnels.
Yeah.
But tunnels are not a necessary part of the Underground Railroad story. And I say that 19th century because you'll find these 19th century houses like up in Troy and some other places where there's a tunnel from the house to a place, a room for a stronghold where maybe the money was kept or
right.
something like that. That's what that was. That's not the Underground Railroad.
Let's take a break here. Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project join us, and we have a lot of calls on the line. We will get to them in a moment. 800-348-2551 is the number. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We have Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region with us today. And let's grab some calls in rapid succession here. We'll go to line 6 and Don in Plattsburgh. Don, you're on.
Hi, Mary Liz and Paul. Don Papson
here. Hey, Don.
Hi, Don.
Just calling to congratulate you and thank you for all you're doing. Ruby and I are on our way to Burlington. We happened to catch the program.
Oh, fine.
I have one thing that I'd like to ask you if you could do, though, and that is to say something about the consortium and also about how Albany was so important to other lines that extended from Albany into Vermont and up into the Champlain Valley and, of course, across the center of New York. So that people get a sense of the significance of Albany to the larger picture up here.
Absolutely, Don. Thanks for bringing that up. Do you want to?
You want to do the?
Oh, I'll start with the consortium,
yeah.
if I may.
Sure.
The Underground Railroad Consortium of New York State is a collaborative venture that was incorporated in 2015, and it arose out of a previous governor's efforts to actually set up 5 historic trails around New York State. The office, when there was a changing of the guard at the governor's level, that particular office was closed, but what remained was about 26, 23 or 26 vetted sites that had been accepted onto this Underground Railroad Heritage Trail that I had mentioned quickly earlier. And all of these vetted sites were very interested in continuing to bring the story forward. And so what they decided to do in 2015 was to bring their forces together to form the consortium, which again has become a collaborative venture, both to support the work that's going on in each of these sites around the state, north, south, east, west, as well as plan programming that continues to bring the story to the public.
Now, I know Don mentioned sort of where Albany was, Paul, you made a point of saying, listen, it's not always about maps and arrows, but in this case, it is.
This is Albany played a central role. I think that a lot of times we around Albany, we like to throw around the term Smallbany, like somehow Albany is diminutive or whatever. And certainly compared, say, with metropolitan New York or something like that, obviously we're a small town. But back in those days, Albany was much larger in relation to other cities. It was the beginning point for the Erie Canal. We've sort of like covered up the Erie Canal that was here in Albany. We filled in Lock 1. Erie Boulevard, which is where the canal ran, is a street now. And even going all the way up into Waterford, we pretty much don't see a canal as far as our connection. But it was the beginning point for the Erie Canal, and in that sense, the end point for shipping that was coming up the river. It played a much more central role. And of course, people who were finding their way to Albany, might be sent to Troy or over into Vermont. They might be sent north towards Plattsburgh. They might be sent kind of like sort of northeast up into toward Oswego to cross Lake Ontario to go to Toronto, or they might have gone west on the canal to the Niagara frontier.
And some may have stayed here, too.
So Albany was a connection point for a lot of transit.
Well, Don, thank you for that call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Roger in New Lebanon. Roger, you're on.
Hello. Hi. I was working on a home in New Lebanon, and it was a very old home, and it had been built before the Civil War. And when I was crawling in the crawl space, I found under the staircase a space, and it had a place to sit, and it had a Bible, and it had a candle holder. And I always thought that might have been some space that was – and the Shakers were very loved by the Native Americans, and I can only imagine that they were really good people, that they would have – given shelter to somebody passing through.
Mm-hmm. So, Roger, is your question about whether or not this particular building has a relationship to Underground Railroad history?
I felt that somehow when I found that in under the house, there was no way it wasn't accessible, and it obviously had been there a long time. Squirrels left little things in there, and I just felt that there may have been some space that was used for the Underground Railway.
And one thing I would like to say, and that is, as you bring this up, and Jason, an earlier caller, also had a question related to a building, and something I would like to say is that there are accounts of slave catchers making their way into New York State, as far north as Plattsburgh, as far west as Niagara Falls, and so on. So I offer that because there's some thinking that, well, we're in New York State, so we don't need hiding places. We don't need, sort of safe havens or things like that. And the reality was, yes, in fact, we do. So, researching the space that you're referencing, the age of the house, when it was built, who lived there, again, accessing historic resource folks in
the
community.
The age of the Bible would tell you.
That might help, yes, yes.
Family, yeah. And it was the Shaker family that built the house. So I traced it back to that. And it was interesting for me. My grandfather did the same thing in Denmark. He had a space in his house during the war, and he hid Jewish people in there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that I think is equally fascinating, I mean, we're always kind of like revisiting the story and try to sort things out. We have found that there were a number of stories of what would be considered radical abolitionists and also African-American abolitionists, where their tendency was to not necessarily to have any place like a secret hiding place. You know, the home itself was a place of refuge. And if you read the stories carefully, there's interesting, we were down in New York City at the, is it the Good Shepherd Church, the church where they have underground area.
Plymouth Church. Plymouth Church.
Where, and there's certainly a lot of talk about, you know, people staying in this underground area there as part of the church, kind of a basement area. But if you read the accounts that are in the glass cases of the minister who talked about what his interactions were, you can kind of see that he was probably having people over to his house, you know, eating dinner at the dinner table, not just having people hide out in the basement of the church. Mm-hmm. That's another angle on the story of the Underground Railroad that I think often gets overlooked. People like to think of the exotic and the romantic.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of instances. There's a fellow, Abel Brown, that we talk a lot about in this region. And he very clearly was somebody who didn't have people hiding somewhere in his house. Mm-hmm. You know, he probably had an extra room, and he just put him up there, had him eat with him at the dinner table, et cetera, like that. Yeah. So not this kind of hidey
thing. And yet that doesn't mean that there isn't a relationship with the space that's being identified.
And the other thing that I want to quick to tack on right with that is there are lots of stories of freedom seekers who came up into the Capital Region and I'm sure many other places where their quote-unquote hiding was that they came up here, they found a place to live, they got a job, and they went to work every day.
Yeah.
The story of Charles Nall, which is a famous story up in the city of Troy. He was working for Uri Gilbert, who was a car manufacturer, a rail car coach manufacturer. And, basically Charles Nall went to work every day, and that was part and parcel of his quote-unquote hiding from the folks in Virginia who were ultimately after him.
Mary Liz and Paul Stewart join us today from the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region. The number is 800-348-2551. Sheila is in Pittsfield. Sheila.
Hi.
Hi Sheila.
I just wanted to give out the information that if you're trying to search who lived in a house, every state has online records of every deed. So you can go to your state's website. In Massachusetts, it's masslandrecords.org, and put in the address, and you can get every deed that was recorded since that house ever was sold, whether it be in the 1800s or whenever.
Okay, great suggestion.
So for that earlier caller who wanted to know, he only knew that there were two generations of ownership that he could attest to. He can find out every single person who owned that house and go back and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
thank
you very much. And then he'd do a little bit of additional research to kind of fill out who those people were and what their story was.
And
what they were connected with.
All right, let's go to Reed in North Greenbush. Reed, you're on.
Oh, I'm on. Quickly, I'm in a checkout line, but some 20 years ago in Coxsackie, I believe, a realtor said, I don't want anybody to find out about this, but in the back of the house, in the woods, there was a tombstone, and it said, colored soldier. Hmm. And I've been wanting to tell somebody about this forever, or maybe seven.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm familiar a little bit that in years past it was not always necessary for people to be buried in a cemetery, and then sometimes people are buried in other places, and possibly that's what was going on there. And of course, the colored soldier probably would have been a Civil War veteran, from was involved in the U.S. colored troops, So there were as many as 200,000 or more African-Americans who were fighting on the side of the Union Army by the time the Civil War was concluded.
Okay. Well, if it's still there, do you want to know about it?
Well, there's probably a lot of things in a lot of places. If you want to send us an email through our website, we'd be happy to kind of converse with you further on that.
And once again, that URL is?
UndergroundRailroadHistory.org.
Okay. Reed, thanks a lot. A few emails here. This one came in from Aaron from the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater.
Yay.
Aaron writes, I was recently in touch with the Stewarts about Harriet Meyer's brother, John Johnson, who was the captain of a sloop. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more generally how the Hudson was used by the Underground Railroad. We only have a couple of minutes. So.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that that we've seen a lot of is that, you know, in terms of the steamboats that were operating on the river, that some of them were operated by abolitionists. And we do know that Stephen Myers, for some period of time, who certainly had the reputation of being a person that connected folks and provided safe haven for folks here in Albany, was also a steward on some of these steamboats. So that has been a connection. Mm. And we do, I want to say that we speculate a little bit on the story of John Johnson, who was an African-American sloop captain. We are aware that he owned two sloops. We're not sure exactly where they fit in the chronology, but one was called the Miriam, the other was called the Jane, and that one of them, the Jane, he bought in the 1830s. There are some records from the Albany County Hall of Records that help us sort that out.
And there's also, as I recall, it may have been a newspaper reference, but there's a small document that we have that indicates that John Johnson was carrying goods as well as people when he was moving between the two cities. More research to be done in terms of that whole piece.
This email came in from John, subject heading Otisville Clue to Research. John writes, I grew up in Otisville and Mr. Sam Free, who at the time during the early 70s was said to be 94 to 95 years old, an incredible man, truly. It was also said that his father was a slave. Mm-hmm. How Mr. Free came to Otisville may be key to Otisville's participation in the Underground Railroad. Mr. Free lived in the house on the corner of Shoddy Hollow and Route 211.
Cool.
That's really excellent, you know, information to fill out the story. The other thing, though, it reminds me of is that I think we all, as New Yorkers, would do well to remind ourselves that New York State had a significant investment in the institution of slavery. And so while our focus today is on the Underground Railroad aspect to this piece in American history, New York State was heavily invested in supporting the institution of slavery even after it abolished the institution of slavery within its borders in 1827.
Mm. All right, this last email here, and then we will wrap up. This one's from Mark. Recently, the movie 12 Years a Slave showed a connection between slavery and the Saratoga area. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what were some of the other local cities and towns that had a connection to either slavery or the Underground Railroad? We only have about a minute here.
Well, you know, I mean, coming up, I mean, starting in New York City, I mean, as far as New York is concerned, you know, New York City, many of the cities up and down the Hudson Valley had active anti-slavery groups.
But also, I think we need to remember that New York City, this was the late 1790s, right, early 1800s, New York City had such a large enslaved population that it was only second to Charleston.
Mm. Yeah.
And
I know there's I can see this note up here.
And yeah, we really don't have time to take another call. But
there is a lot of positive connotations to the whole Smallbony thing. I think small towns are wonderful.
Well, you're doing great work. Are you doing any presentations that we should know about coming up in the next few weeks? I know you did one in Troy.
We have people can come to the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence. We're open from 5 to 8 Monday through Friday and from noon to 4 on Saturdays. We've had groups. We had a group in just a few days.
Yeah, we have some more groups
ago.
Coming, too.
Yeah.
So that's an option. I can't think of any public speaking engagements, but we're always open to being invited, so we certainly would love to. Yeah.
Well, listen, we'll have you back here because once again, we had a list of things to talk about and we never get to all of them. So next time, we'll make it 2 hours. I don't know. Hey, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Support comes from Curtis Lumber, featuring Valspar interior and exterior paints, cabot stains, and more at 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com. And Penny Farthing, Socially Responsible Investment Management of Personal Retirement and Endowment Portfolios, Amherst, PennyFarthingInvestment.com, Eric Bright, CFA. Once again, thanks to Mary Liz and Paul Stewart of the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region for joining us today. Links to their website on our website, wamc.org/voxpop. Thank you for calling. Sorry if we didn't get to your call today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones were answered by Ed Rosen, our producer. Well, we have two now, Jim Lavoulis and Jackie Orchard. We are twice blessed. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, we start thinking spring. It's gardening at 2 p.m. Right now, stand by for 51%.